of the day then is Wheat versus Prospect Funding Partners LLC. Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter, and Justice Papik is recused from this matter. The court will be joined by Judge Pirtle and Judge Bishop of the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, may I approach the blood robber?
You certainly may. Thank you very much. And you are Ms.?
I am Ms. Donna Colley, C-O-L-L-E-Y, here on behalf of Mrs. Wheat, Ronald J. Pelagi, and appearing as attorney for, in the absence of Mr. Pelagi this morning.
Ms. Colley, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Welcome to the bench, to the newcomers this morning. I'm here this morning about a case that started with a personal injury. Mr. Pelagi represented the other party in the case, who is an appellant, Mrs. Wheat. Mrs. Wheat is an elderly lady who was thrown off a balcony by a neighbor, and she ended up with severe brain damage and over $250,000 in medical bills.
What do we know from the record about the nature of Ms. Wheat's claim or the settlement?
Your Honor, I think the only thing that we know, I don't know that the details of Mrs. Wheat's capacity to agree to this, for example. I think there was no discovery done. I think if the case had not been granted a summary judgment, I think we would have done discovery on whether or not Mrs. Wheat had the capacity to enter into this agreement at the time that she did because of the head injury, but no discovery was allowed.
When the summary judgment motion was filed and pending, was there ever a request to forestall a decision or to continue the hearing to permit discovery?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
Where is that in our record?
Oh, Your Honor, I did not bring the pleadings up here. My recollection is that there was at least one motion prior to the hearing on summary judgment asking for additional discovery. I believe during the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, a request was made orally, and I believe after the hearing, and counsel is going to be more familiar with the record than I, there was a motion both to amend the pleadings to make it absolutely clear Mr. Pelagi was seeking to vacate the underlying arbitration, and he was also seeking at that point to withdraw because at that point the dual counsel became diverged somewhat in that now Mr. Pelagi under the motion was going to become personally liable, or his law firm was, for the judgment as well. So it is my, again, Your Honor, perhaps in my rebuttal time I'll reserve a minute. I'll look through the pleadings and perhaps be able to answer exactly when that was filed. Would that
Thank
be
you.
Acceptable? So the end result in this case is what I want to bring to your attention because it strikes at the heart of what we all do as attorneys and judges. This is a case where a lady of the most vulnerable, remember this company that we're dealing with looks for vulnerable people. That's who their target already.
Well, wasn't she represented at the time that she entered into that agreement?
She was represented in regard to the personal injury action, correct.
Well, what about the arbitration agreement?
The arbitration agreement was contained in the document that she signed.
And Mr. Pelagi was her lawyer at the time, was he not?
He did not represent her in regard to that. What these companies asked the attorney to do is to sign a statement saying that, yes, there is a claim, and yes, if money comes in, I will hold it, which is exactly what Mr. Pelagi did. In fact, he went the next step and followed the rules of professional responsibility that say that if money comes within your possession and you're not sure who it belongs to, you file a motion with the court. You don't become an arbitrator and decide on your own whether or not Mrs. Wheat had capacity, whether or not it's unconscionable, whether or not the company was properly doing business in Nebraska, whether or not they had complied with the non-recourse law, whether it was unconscionable.
Didn't Mr. Pelagi also sign an acknowledgement that he would follow his client's instructions to not disperse any funds to her until he had paid back Prospect from any settlement? There was a letter of direction that was acknowledged by the lawyer?
I think there is a letter of direction that is clear, but it did not bind Mr. Pelagi. He did not say he personally was going to arbitrate his own case with the company. That's a whole other issue in this case, is Mr. Pelagi did not enter into an agreement to waive his right to civil litigation and agree to arbitration in any way of any liability that he had.
So Mr. Pelagi signed the sales and repurchase agreement in his individual capacity, is that correct? What did his signature block on that document look like? Was he signing on behalf of himself or on behalf of the firm?
My position would be that when Mr. Pelagi was signing any document on behalf of the client, that he is signing on behalf of the firm. I'm looking at the document. It's an attorney acknowledgement at the second page of it, and what it says under the signature block is Ronald J. Pelagi Esquire, is what it says, Your Honor.
The arbitration was brought against the law firm, correct?
That is correct.
Does that make a difference?
I think it does make a difference. I think, again, there's no jurisdiction over Mr. Pelagi or the law firm. The law firm nor Mr. Pelagi agreed to arbitrate any civil liability that the law firm or Mr. Pelagi had. So I don't think the arbitration agreement has anything to do with Mr. Pelagi. I think the court became overly focused on the fact that there had been this arbitration and did not do what the complaint asked. Mr. Pelagi said, I have money in my hands and I'm not sure who it belongs to. I'm concerned this could be unconscionable. And the reason he said that, at the end of the day, our client and Mr. Pelagi are paying 426% interest. Judges, she held on to money, $5,000 for less than 6 months is what she had. So she got the use of $5,000 for less than 6 months, and she now owes $69,000. I mean, is that not textbook unconscionability? You would think there'd be a law against that, and in fact, there is a law against that in Nebraska. It's called the Non-Litigation Recourse Act.
It's not against it. It actually facilitates it, does it not?
Well, I think it facilitates it in a way that the company that wants to do this type of business, that wants to seek out the vulnerable like Mrs. Sweet, who's been injured, that there is an extra requirement. And this particular company hasn't met either requirement. They're not licensed to do business, and so arguably the court should have immediately found you can't use the state of Nebraska or our courts to enforce this. Sure, the underlying agreement in theory is still valid, but as a judge, will the courts of Nebraska allow you to use our courts in order to enforce this? The answer is no. And the answer is no because they're not registered to do business here, nor did they comply with the Non-Recourse Civil Litigation Act. And the agreement, the underlying agreement, is woefully inadequate in a number of respects.
How did you attack
yes, sir?
The arbitration in that regard, the unconscionability regard?
How did we attack it in the arbitration itself? Is that your question, Your Honor?
In the arbitration itself or in the district court?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, let's go through the dates. If I'm not mistaken, that the arbitration against Mr. Pelagi is entered on June 8th of 2016. The arbitration against Mrs. Sweet is entered on August 3rd. The lawsuit asking the court to decide what should happen to the money is filed June 16th. So it goes like this. June 8th, arbitration against the law firm, and as Justice points out, the law firm did not sign anything. So June 8th, 2016, against the law firm. June 6th, Mr. Pelagi files the lawsuit in Nebraska and says, court, please help me. I'm not supposed to arbitrate this. I'm supposed to look to you. And in that...
Didn't mention the arbitration at all in the complaint, did he?
Absolutely did not, Your Honor.
Thank
absolutely
you.
Did not. What he asked her to do is to see who is owed this money. It is then 2 months later, the court has had this case for 2 months, when then the arbitration is entered against Mrs. Wheat. The court never did do what Mr. Pelagi asked in his complaint. And his complaint was, Judge, I have money. And under the rules of Nebraska, it says right in the requirements, is that the attorney is to file a lawsuit, to bring a suit to determine who is entitled to the money. And that's exactly what Mr. Pelagi did. And this argument that, well, he didn't do it timely because it should have been within 3 months of the arbitration.
Isn't that what the arbitration agreement said, that you had 3 months to contest the results of the arbitration?
Right, but we were already in court. So the first arbitration award is against the law firm who never signed anything. So we've got big red flag there. So the arbitrator absolutely has never had jurisdiction over Mr. Pelagi's law firm, ever, because they didn't sign anything. So you can't, the federal
arbitration... That wasn't raised in the district court, though, was it?
I think you're correct, Your Honor.
You're talking about the nature of the action that was filed in district court, and I'm curious about that because I couldn't quite figure out whether an interpleader action was filed or a declaratory judgment action was filed or some sort of mashup of the two. It was clear that Mr. Pelagi had an interest in the outcome, and we've got clear law on interpleader that would foreclose that. But it looked to me like the district court and perhaps the appellee's brief construed this district court action as a declaratory judgment. Would you agree with that construction?
Well, I think the way it was styled, if I'm remembering it correctly, it was a mashup. It was asking for a declaratory judgment and an impleader, and he asked to be able to, he had the check there, if I'm not mistaken, attached to the complaint and said, I want to tender to the court the amount that was due at that point, $8,000-some.
So, was that the amount due or the amount that could have repurchased the claim?
You know, that's interesting. I think it's the amount to repurchase is the way it's worded, if I'm not mistaken. You may be correct. $8,200-some, I think, was the amount of the check, and that's what was at issue at that point. And again, as we stand here today, we're talking about $63,000. So this argument that it's unconscionable is pretty obvious. There's no doubt about it. I have no other questions at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barney, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Adam Barney with the law firm of Klein, Williams, Wright, Johnson, and Oldfather. And we represent the appellee in this matter, Prospect Funding Holdings, NY, LLC.
Can you just clarify the facts for us a little bit, please?
Sure.
And the timing of all this?
The timing as with respect to the filing of the arbitrations and the filing of the complaint in the district court.
Or what about the underlying claim, how it all came about, how the funding company even got involved? Can you give us some background on that?
I'll do my best. I also was not trial counsel on this matter, and those are issues that I was not familiar with necessarily coming into this appeal. But generally speaking, I believe an action was filed, personal injury action was filed by Mrs. Wheat, represented by Mr. Pelagi and his firm. Sometime in connection with that, my client was contacted to purchase an interest in that piece of litigation.
Your client was contacted, or your client contacted Mrs. Wheat?
I don't believe the record has any facts as to whether one way or the other, Your Honor. And the sale and repurchase agreement was executed. At some point in time later, the underlying litigation was settled. After that time, arbitrations were filed at or around the same time that Mr. Pelagi filed the what may be an interpleader, what may be partially a declaratory judgment action. It is unclear. The arbitrations were filed before that action was filed. The awards were issued right around the time that the complaint was filed by the appellants in this matter. That is really the timing leading up to where we are here today. Looking at this case, and with all due respect to the tragic circumstances and injuries of Mrs. Wheat, the factual background here really is irrelevant for the most part. The issues presented here on appeal are governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, the FAA, and the trial court here properly applied the FAA, and its opinion and judgment should be affirmed.
Does 25-3307 apply to your client?
I'm sorry.
For registration?
It does
under
not.
Under the civil litigation funding, it does not apply.
It does not. Not in this action. And if it had applied, that argument would have needed to be made to the arbitrators and not to the court. And that really gets to the crux of where we are here today on this appeal. Each of the assignments of error is really effectively arguing the same thing, that the sale and repurchase agreement is void and or unenforceable. But we've already had two arbitrators look at the issue and decide that it's not, that or excuse me, that the sale and repurchase agreement is enforceable. And those arbitrators, separate arbitrators, have issued awards in favor of my client and against both the appellants.
Did either of the arbitrators consider or address any of the challenges to the validity of the contract that were raised by Mr. Pelagi?
There was an email that was sent in one of the arbitrations in which there are arguments made about the enforceability. Beyond that, both awards do mention the enforceability, and they found explicitly in the awards that the sale and repurchase agreement was enforceable.
And didn't that turn on the absence of what both arbitrators construed, or what both arbitrators construed as the absence of any evidence offered by the respondent on the validity?
Sure, but they're looking at it all.
Not on the merits.
Well, not necessarily. I think they were looking at the merits. They look at the facts, and they look at the facts that are presented to them. And the facts that were presented to them, and or the lack thereof that was presented to them, they found the sale and repurchase agreement to be enforceable, and that is their ruling. So now we're sitting here today with assignments of error, effectively looking for a reconsideration of those arbitration awards. With all due respect to this court and to the court below, there's no authority to reconsider those awards. Under the FAA, a party has limited grounds to address or to challenge an arbitration award. And if a party does not challenge those arbitration awards within 3 months, it waives its challenges.
Within 3 months of what, counsel?
Within 3 months of the arbitration awards are filed or delivered.
And where do they file? I'm sorry.
No, please. That's what I was going to ask.
Where do they file that challenge?
Where do they file
the challenge to the arbitration award?
The appellants would file the challenge to the arbitration award in the court.
In the district court where they filed their pleading?
They could. They could file a challenge in a court of a competent jurisdiction. And there is no dispute that the district court would have been a proper venue for that.
So if they would have been more specific in their pleading that they were challenging this arbitration award, then the timeliness factor wouldn't be an issue.
Had they actually challenged the awards in their complaint, the timeliness would not be an issue, but they didn't.
So their pleading was timely. They just failed to put the right positions or arguments in that pleading.
I would argue their pleading under the FAA, which says
3 months.
3 months. You have to file a motion to vacate within 3 months. Mm-hmm. There was no motion to vacate within 3 months, and in fact, there's never been a motion to vacate filed.
So Section 12 requires that the motion to vacate be filed within 3 months after the award is, quote, filed or delivered.
Yes.
And my question to you is, what evidence is there in our record of the date on which the arbitration award was filed or delivered? We see its issuance date. What do we know about the date it was filed or delivered?
I don't know if there's anything in the record as the issues were presented here for the court as to whether the date of filed or delivered.
Is that a material dispute of fact that would preclude summary judgment?
No, because at the district court level, as the district court found, there was no dispute that there was no motion to vacate within 3 months. And again,
the court found it had been waived because it was more than 3 months.
No, the district court found that it had been more than 3 months since a motion to vacate had been filed. And in fact, there had been no motion to vacate. And that issue was not disputed by the appellants. There was no issue in the trial court. Nobody disputed that. I don't know if the pleadings presently in the record show when that was filed or delivered. I do know that it was filed and delivered, and if that is a question for the court, I would ask leave to supplement with some additional records from the transcript. I believe there was an August 2017 motion to intervene that attached both of the arbitration awards. So at the very latest, it would have been the August 2017 that they were filed and delivered. The FAA does not speak plainly to what you have to do to file or deliver an arbitration award. It really is kind of something that hasn't been addressed very widely in the federal or state courts. Even assuming there had been a timely motion to vacate, this court should properly affirm this action or this appeal. We've addressed in our brief why each one of the specific assignments are without error or are without merit. But when looking at the Federal Arbitration Act, even under a timely motion to vacate, this court's inquiry into the arbitration awards is limited. And this, you can leave this room in 10 minutes and be convinced that the arbitrators committed grave error, but affirmance is still proper. So long as the arbitrators were even arguably construing sale and repurchase agreement, arbitration awards have to be confirmed under the FAA. Looking back to some of the arguments that Justice Stacey, you addressed with appellants, yes, Mr. Pelagi is the individual who signed on, signed the sale and repurchase agreement. That was not an issue that has been assigned as error, as you pointed out. I'll also note, this court does have authority, Electronic Development Company, 148 Nebraska 526, that discusses when an agent or a president or a principal of an entity signs an agreement, they are presumptively, so long as it's within the normal course of their business, they are presumptively acting on behalf of that business. So we would suggest that authority, to the extent this had even been assigned as error, would support the action against the Pelagi law firm instead of Mr. Pelagi individually.
Was the issue of Ms. Wheat's competency ever raised in the district court matter?
It was not. I don't believe so.
And as far as you know, was Mr. Pelagi continuously representing her throughout all of these timelines that we've been talking about?
From my understanding, and from what I believe the record shows, Mr. Pelagi from day one in the underlying litigation up until this appeal here today has represented Mrs. Wheat. Unless the court has any further questions about any of the specific assignments of error, we would ask the court.
Can you tell me again why 253307 does not apply?
Under the Litigation Funding Company Act? I can't, sitting here today, it was not something that was assigned as error.
Well, they talk about 253303, which is under the same act, with regard to a lawyer who signs off on such an agreement in terms of their responsibilities. So I'm trying to understand more clearly why you believe this act doesn't apply.
Sure. So that specific assignment of error relates to what the duties are of Mr. Pelagi in the underlying litigation, which was not an issue here with regard to the arbitration awards. With regard to the application of 253307, I apologize, I don't have an answer here for you today. It's a specific.
So this was not a civil litigation funding situation?
It was generally a civil litigation funding situation. To the extent it did apply, that would be an issue that would have needed to have been raised in the arbitration.
So you're not saying it absolutely didn't apply. You're saying that it should, if it did apply, it should have been raised. So
I'm not conceding that it applies. Yeah. But to the extent that it did, because it needed to be raised in the arbitration.
I think I recall seeing somewhere where you conceded that the company had not registered as required under this act.
The company had not registered as it relates to generally registration of limited liability companies in this state. That is because they are not transacting business in this state, as this court has defined. We are dealing with an interstate transaction, which falls outside those grounds of dealing business in this state and having to register in this state.
So separate and apart from which state law applies, and I'm not asking you for a conflicts of law analysis, I'm asking simply, did the sale and repurchase agreement here comply with Nebraska's Non-Recourse Civil Litigation Act? Yes or no?
As it's not been assigned as error, I haven't specifically looked at it. I do believe there's probably there would be a question if that had been raised with the arbitrators, whether it amounts to clear, grave error that they are not arguably considering the sale and repurchase agreement. I don't think it rises to that level under the FAA, and that's what this court is confined to, is the grounds for vacating under the FAA, even under a timely motion to vacate. Thank you. We would ask the district court's order be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, may I approach to correct the record in regard to something that Judge Stacy said?
There is no time for rebuttal. We'll let you do it.
That's fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I see that we don't want the soul to be barren, so I'll take that as you helping me out there. Thank you. You were asking Judge Stacy whether or not there was a motion in regard to discovery. And if on January 29 of 2018, excuse me, I got the wrong date, we filed a motion to continue. On December 13 of 2017, and if you look in that motion to continue, it is in regard to discovery. And if I'm not mistaken, if you look at the transcript on the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, that the inadequate discovery responses are part of that hearing, and that was one of the reasons that Mr. Pelagi had contested summary judgment, was that the defendant had not properly answered discovery. And then let me lastly point out
that in our complaint, the original complaint, we specifically described how it is that this agreement does not comply with Nebraska law, the non-recourse litigation funding statute. We described that in quite some detail.
Did you raise those arguments in opposition to the motion for summary judgment?
Yes, ma'am. Those were raised.
Thank you very much.
The court only ruled in regard to the one issue. Thank you, Judge. May I bring one case to your attention? I apologize. The Eighth Circuit has ruled in a case, Energy Operations versus United Government, 856 Fed Third 561, that public policy, which we have a public policy on this, can be grounds to contest an arbitration, even under the Federal Arbitration Act. So saying that the underlying agreement it violates our public policy, as stated in the Non-Recourse Litigation Act, is a legitimate reason to set aside an arbitration. So I bring that to your attention.
Was that argument presented to the district court below?
Your Honor, I think in a general sense, I don't think that case was presented. I'm quite certain of that. But I do think in a general sense that the idea that this agreement, the underlying agreement, the arbitration was all void ab initio, that it was void from the beginning, was brought to the court because of public policy. And I feel quite certain that that argument was made. Thank you, and thank you for indulging me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused. But before you go, I want to thank our bailiff, Laura. This is her last day with us, and she has been fantastic while she's been here. And we invite her to come back anytime. Thank you, Laura, very much.
Thank you, Laura.